Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, as you should be.
And if not, you're tuned to the wrong program.
Yes, exactly.
So welcome aboard once again.
And you know, this is going to be a really good program if I do say so myself.
It is. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about with some authors and product manufacturers about how you make food taste better. In a variety of different ways. Ways that in a couple of cases, I didn't even know you could do safely. So that's going to be fun. And then, we can't leave London and the Olympics behind without indulging in our taste for candy, the world's taste for chocolate, and a London-based chocolatier called Paul Young, who's replaying from a previous program, who's fabulous. Several stores in London, but more than anything, it's a whole feature ending the program about the national sweet tooth that Britons have. And if you share that sweet tooth, well, you should certainly make sure that you get some while you're there.
Right.
But anyway, let's back to the main theme of the program.
Alex.
It's about different ways of making food taste better, fermenting, which possibly came first.
Yeah, do you know the salting chocolate
salting
fermenting?
And, yes. No, uh-huh. I didn't know that.
I didn't know until I read
the
book.
Well, you're always interrupting. Salting and seasoning comes next. And David Joachim talking about a line of salt and spice combined. And then sweetening, of course, a very important thing. But sweetening with a rather unusual sweetening ingredient coming from trees, not from plants. So see if you can guess what that is before we get there. And then finally we're going to close up with London-based chocolatier Paul Young. So that's what's in today's program. So without further ado, let's turn ourselves over to our interview with Alex Lewin.
Yes.
Who's going to talk to us all about fermenting.
Okay, so the book's called Real Food Fermentation. The author is Alex Lewin, who admits to being a Harvard graduate, although we know from his telephone number that he's hanging out on the left coast. But I'm really worried that you started off on this just because you kept some leftover food for too long and it started to look interesting, and then all of a sudden you became totally engrossed with the world of preparing food, not by cooking it, which does bad things to it, but by fermenting it, which does good things to it.
Yeah, to contradict, however, but Alex is a graduate of the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts and the Institute for Integrative Nutrition.
But at Harvard.
At Harvard, true.
It's at Harvard. That's why he has a Harvard.
I know that, but I'm just saying that it's a really important program, and I could just see how this would have come about considering the commercial industrial food scene.
I'm impressed, Alex. I thought the remark you made before we came on the air that you thought that a Harvard email address extension might last longer than Google and Yahoo. And I'm not sure that's true, but it's a nice return to reality. But what you're doing in this book is a return to reality, because it seems like it might be a modern book, but in fact, fermenting a food is really very ancient, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the oldest ways of preserving food, probably discovered by accident, as many important things are.
Okay.
Probably, as you said, probably somebody left something out for too long. Not that there is anywhere else to put it before there is refrigeration. But they discovered that not only had this food not rotted, but it was actually better. And then they saw what happened and figured out how to duplicate it, and there was fermented food.
Because it's always worried me, just as an aside, around the table must have been somewhat littered with bodies in a long ago past. Sort of like people who sat down to dinner with the Borgias. because somebody had to figure out that this wasn't very good. It was either poisonous or it was rotten or something else was wrong with it.
Well, I wonder about that too, but if you look at the animal kingdom, most animals instinctively know what's good to eat and what's not. And I would speculate that once upon a time humans had that intuition also, and that we've become so civilized that we've lost it. So I don't know.
But anyway, own up to why did you become so fascinated with this? It's clear from the book, which Anne's been reading to me chapter by chapter over the last several days, that you've totally become obsessed with this particular subject. But how did that really start out?
I will admit to it, yes. I've always been interested in food, and I've always been interested in food that's a little off the beaten path. And my first real fermented food obsession, maybe, I mean, aside from beer and wine and cheese and the usual, was kimchi.
Oh, yeah.
And the first time I had kimchi, it was so unlike anything else that people eat, at least in the United States. I was like, okay, I have to have more of this. And so I started making my own kimchi, and I started going to Korean restaurants a lot to search for the best kimchi. And then I happened upon a book by Sandra Katz called Wild Fermentation, and I discovered all the other things that can be fermented, and I read enough in that book to understand why the kimchi recipe works the way it does.
Well, and of course, this is how you get Roquefort cheese, it's how you get all kinds of things, but I keep stopping Peter from hanging up some duck in our basement because I'm not so sure about what other kind of microbes there are hanging around.
Well, it's true, fermenting vegetable matter, carbohydrate in general, and fermenting dairy are a lot easier than fermenting meat. Fermenting meat, you do have to be a little bit careful. When you're fermenting vegetables and dairy, if it doesn't work, you'll know. It'll be obvious.
Yeah, well, I remember those the canned jars of tomatoes in, growing up, that every so often there would be one of them exploding.
Well, and canning is another thing.
You're against that, too.
To say I'm against it is
a little too strong.
Maybe too strong, but I don't do canning myself just because it's a very temperamental process, and if you don't get it just right, then as you say, your
botulism.
botulism. I was going to say, as you say, your jars can explode, but botulism is a worse outcome than losing a little tomato sauce.
Why don't you start by explaining to us what is the difference between, which was new to me, in fact, I want to interject here, that I thought I knew a lot of things that I didn't know anything about until I read this book. I learned things that will have me worried now for a long time. But what is the difference between pickling and fermentation?
Pickling is a somewhat, I don't want to say it's a vague term. People don't necessarily always stop to think about what it means exactly.
Uh-huh.
To me, pickling means preserving something in an acidic medium. So the range of microbes that will grow in an acidic medium is quite limited, and none of them are deadly. So if you put something in acid, basically you can preserve it for a long time. And so that's colloquially, that's pickling. And so in general, you can do that very easily with vinegar. So a lot of pickles are just submerged in vinegar. And then you can submerge something in vinegar and pretty much call it a day, and it's pickled. Now, fermentation is more specific and more complicated.
And more graceful, too. Your images of all these little microbes chewing away at things, they're beautiful.
Well, thank you.
But why do they eat the centers of the cucumbers? That was bothering me.
Fermentation of food is the transformation of the food via the action of microbes. Microbes are invisible, I don't know if I can call them creatures, living organisms that are all around us and are inside of us. And in fact, of the living cells in our bodies, 10 times more of them are bacteria than human cells.
You know, I've been reading about this. Was it The Economist did that piece, Peter, about how we're this aggregate of all these other cells that have nothing to do with what we think of as a human being.
It's true. We are more like a terrarium than we are like a
That's it.
Creature.
No, it's really funny. Now, they made Jamie Lee Curtis stop talking about that.
I need to read this article. It sounds good.
Well, if we can find it, I will refer you to it.
Excellent.
Some of these things I didn't realize you would call fermented. I mean, obviously sauerkraut I know about. Chocolate I didn't know about.
Well, so in order to transform cacao plant into a form that we're familiar with, there's a fermentation process that has to take place that transforms the flavor profile. You can eat raw cacao, but it's kind of bitter.
Yeah, it has to be bitter. Yeah.
Yeah. So fermentation changes the flavors. And the same for coffee, same for vanilla.
Yeah, vanilla, which is an orchid, right?
Now, I'm sort of comparing this mentally to the action of bacteria, I guess, or microbes or whatever you call them, or yeasts as we more commonly know them, in the process of fermenting the sugar in vegetables and fruits to make wine.
Yeah, but now she's going
to... But this is different than that.
He's going to tell us there are 3 different microbes we should be...
Let's
why don't you tell us the 3 different microbes and what they react on most successfully?
Well, so to speak in very general terms, actually I'll start with yeasts. So yeasts act on sugars and turn them into alcohol. Bacteria act on sugars or alcohol and turn it into acid. And then molds do other things which are harder to generalize about. But molds play roles in, well, cheese that we know of, but also some Asian foods also. And nobody wants to think about eating moldy food, but of course anyone who likes blue cheese or soft cheeses is eating mold all the time. It's just a question of eating the right molds rather than the wrong ones.
You give a lot of background in like the history of preserving food and also the different methods of preserving, their pros and their cons, and come up, of course, with, not surprisingly, that fermentation is probably the best way to go because it improves taste, it doesn't destroy nutrients, so it actually improves the food.
Yes. One of the things that happens with the bacteria and the yeast, in the process of transforming the food, they also create byproducts, and some of them are known as vitamins. it's funny, nobody thinks about where vitamins come from, but a lot of them are metabolic waste products of the action of microbes on food.
Well, there you go. But back to Jamie Lee Curtis again. The next thing she's going to be doing is pushing Centrum multivitamins, which we take every day without even thinking about it.
Do you think it's really safer to eat raw milk or to feed it to your children than it is to risk all the processing of the milk that we have when it's what do you call it when you process milk?
Pasteurizing.
We just had recently in this area an outbreak of some sort. They found out later it wasn't really the farmer's fault, but there was some bad raw milk that laid low a lot of people.
But it was pretty small. I mean, the reason for pasteurization was the heavy incidence of tuberculosis
as a disease
that was propagated by raw milk. Once you conquered tuberculosis, you no longer actually really need as desperately to pasteurize milk products, but we do it anyway.
Well, it's a complicated and contentious issue, as you know, no doubt. I think if you're getting milk from small farms with sanitary practices, I think raw milk is safe.
This was a small farm, local.
Yeah. As Peter said, I think a lot of the pasteurization was introduced to combat, I think a lot of the conditions have changed. So, yeah, any food that we eat is going to come with some risk. Raw shellfish, cooked shellfish. I would rather drink a gallon of raw milk every day than, for instance, buy ground beef at a large big box chain store and make hamburgers out of it.
Right. But we're getting off the subject just a little bit.
We are.
Let's just say what the book does for people.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
You start out with the background. We talked about that, the health benefits of fermentation. Then you get into actually the stocking your lab, you call it, all the equipment you need. And then you talk about the product, know your ingredients, and you're pretty thorough in that. And then you use sauerkraut as sort of a general model of fermentation. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then you go on from there. I mean, you also make the case for getting real about food and real food, which is why we emphasize the title of the book. But then you go in. You cover how many different approaches past sauerkraut. Yeah, go through just some of the things that you talk about fermenting, like sauerkraut and kimchi, and go on. What else?
Yes, I take sauerkraut as the archetype of vegetable fermentation, and I look at some variations with more of a sort of coleslaw-type mix of vegetables, kimchi, which includes ginger and onion and garlic and usually red pepper. I look at beets and turnips and things like that, and then pickled cucumbers also. And then I move on to dairy, and
That's amazing. Your chapter on dairy was really very interesting about the difference in the kind of butter we buy and the kind of butter that's cultured. I don't know that.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like that.
Yeah, buying that.
Sure. So in the old days, people would milk their cows, they would skim off the cream, and they would save up enough cream until it made sense to start making butter. And in the meantime, it would all be sitting out somewhere, maybe somewhere cool, maybe not. And so by the time they made the butter, cream would have started to ferment. And so that's why butter had a sort of sour flavor to it. And if you go to Europe, for instance, the butter that you buy still has a sort of sour flavor to it. And some of the artisanal butters in the U.S. have this too. So if you go to a nice restaurant that makes their own butter, a lot of times it'll taste very different from what you buy in the store. The people who make the butter in the supermarket want their butter to taste nice too. So a lot of them add artificial flavorings to make their butter taste like it was made from fermented cream, which is really funny because they could just ferment the cream. But that would take a little more time, and they would have to pay a little more attention to conditions. And so rather than do that, they just add some flavoring.
Okay. Oh, dear.
Yeah, now you have yogurt, and I'm still in mourning for the loss of my culture from Syria.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She only lost it 40 years ago.
Still in mourning. I left it in care of a neighbor while I went to Europe, and she let it die.
Well, you may have to plan another trip to Syria, I guess.
not just now, thank you.
Time to go. And then, of course, you do a lot on the whey, which is also a fermenting, what do you call it, a vehicle?
A starter, yeah.
A starter. And then you move on to, let's see, kefir, is it?
Mm-hmm.
That must be that stuff we drink in Europe all the time, right? They serve it in the breakfast rooms. It's drinkable, right?
Yeah. In fact, there's a whole range of fermented milk products that many Americans don't even know the names of, that I don't know the names of. The starters are quite unique and varied. And the two, I mean, yogurt is the big one we know, and kefir is starting to catch on here. But there's all sorts of other fermented dairy drinks from all over Central Asia and Europe that we don't even know about. And in fact, you know, there are these categories, but really it's a continuum of sort of ecosystems of critters, some of them being purely bacterial, like yogurt, some of them being a combination of bacteria and yeast, like kefir, and some of them with molds. And so there's a whole range of traditional foods that we really aren't familiar with because most of us just buy our food in the supermarket.
Yeah. Well, I like this fermented fruit condiments because we're currently sampling this. It's called pickle, but it's fruit pickles from Boat Street Cafe. And where's that?
It's in Seattle.
Oregon. Oh, in Seattle. And they're just absolutely raisins, figs. I mean, it's absolutely fabulous stuff.
They actually make them in Oregon, but the Boat Street Cafe is in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
So
that's something new. Do you realize that pickling became the big subject of the fancy food shows this year?
My timing is pretty good on the book. I do realize that. Uh-huh. Pickling and fermentation are all of a sudden very trendy and popular. I would like to take credit for it, but that wouldn't really be fair. But I'll take credit for continuing the interest.
Okay, and we might add that you also tackle wines, spirits, ginger ale, other cultured beverages. No, just about everything. Nothing makes you think. That's, I guess, the one thing I'd like to end up with. It really introduces subjects you never even thought of or you thought you knew about and you really didn't. Alex, I think the book is just wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much.
And okay. I'm going to recommend it to anybody I can recommend it to.
That's fantastic.
And you've been a delightful guest on the program as well. So.
And I have to go check those crocs with the sauerkraut.
Yeah, no, let them...
Scrape the mold off of those?
Well, you've been a delightful host. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I hope for your next book we'll do it again.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you, Beth.
And On the Menu will be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, and we are back, of course, and next up we're going to be talking about a new product, Chef Salt, which we've been using over and over again. It's just that there's so many variations of it and it's so good. And we're going to be talking to David Joachim. I have to write out his name every time he's on the show, which he has been on frequently. Anyhow, let's talk about chef salt.
Salting and spicing combined.
Right.
It's called Seasoning Your Food Made Easy, and a fascinating story, so I'm sure you'll enjoy.
David Joachim, I have to keep relearning your name, but I should know by now because this is your fourth appearance on the menu, but you keep doing things.
I do. I'm very prolific, which is why I think I've been back on several times. Mostly it's for cookbooks. Now, this time is a line of seasoning blends.
Yeah. Now, tell us about Chef's Salt. You have a whole range of them, and I read somewhere where you and Andy Schloss and Mark Bitterman, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, who we have had on the show. He wrote that the definitive book on salt, and he sells salt. You started playing around with blends?
Yes, we did. Mark Bitterman is what I would call a salt evangelist. He thinks that most chefs have no idea what they're doing with salt, because most of them use kosher salt, which has a very, very limited use. It's intended for koshering, so it draws moisture out of meat. That's what it's supposed to do, is draw moisture out of meat. So it's terrible for a steak that you're grilling, because it draws moisture out of the steak, and everyone wants a juicy steak, so that's defeating the purpose.
You have no idea how many times I've tried to talk food writers out of just using this kosher salt.
Yeah, it seems to be the default salt for chefs and food writers, and it's mostly because that is what's available. Salt is actually a very industrial product, as we know it, in this country anyway. Most of the salt that is produced goes to manufacturing and the chemical industry for creating other chemical compounds. Only 17% of the salt produced is actually used for food. Only 17%,
that's
a small amount. What's important to note about that is that the way salt is manufactured, it is stripped of all of the minerals that occur naturally in the crystal, except for sodium chloride. So what we taste as salt when we sprinkle table salt or kosher salt or even most labeled sea salt, what we taste is almost 100% sodium chloride. It's
right.
Very one-dimensional.
Yes.
Now, the interesting thing is that, in fact, if you like artisanal sea salts, like you get from the south of France and from various places around the coast of Britain and other parts of the world, do have trace minerals of different kinds, so they do have different flavors. The black salt from Hawaii and the red salt from Hawaii are a couple of other examples, too, where it's not just sodium chloride. It does have trace minerals in it, which make it much more interesting.
Exactly, and that's why we use these salts. We call these culinary salts because they are unrefined. The process is similar to the process of refining grains, where grains are refined and much of the fiber and the beneficial minerals are stripped out. The same process occurs with salt, and these trace minerals that you're talking about are stripped away. So calcium, magnesium, potassium, even though these occur in minute amounts, they are refined out of the crystal, so you're left with almost 100% sodium chloride. And even though those are trace amounts, they are key elements in unrefined salt or artisan salt. And we use those salts exclusively in Chef Salt.
So you're starting off with a fine salt, and then you're adding to it. But I want to explore the concept just a little bit further, because salting things ahead of time or salting things while you're cooking is one thing, but you've done a second thing as well. You've made it easier for people to introduce a flavor.
Yes,
That's not just a salt flavor.
Exactly. Many of these salts are used as finishing salts. They're often called finishing salts. You sprinkle a little bit on at the end. Let's say you have a fine flake salt, like a Malden salt. You would sprinkle that onto a bruschetta or some any other kind of toast or a salad, anywhere where you want to actually taste the delicate crystal structure breaking in your palate as you eat it. That is a finishing salt, where you're really getting the taste and the texture of the salt at the very end. But like you said, we have added seasonings to these special salts that we use, so you can flavor your food, whatever you're making, sometimes in the beginning, sometimes in the middle of cooking, and sometimes at the end, but it's not exclusively at the end. For instance, you can use the Tuscan herb blend of Chef Salt with a little olive oil and lemon juice as a very simple marinade, and that is perfect for any kind of poultry. It's great on vegetables. You can use this Tuscan herb blend, which is a mixture of sel di cervia, which is a salt from cervia in Italy. It's a
ancient Roman salt, it used to be used as currency to pay Roman soldiers, which is actually where the term salary comes from. And this salt
is interesting.
Salad actually comes from the same root as well. But it's an interesting salt because even though it comes in fairly coarse crystals, the rocks of salt are somewhat large, about a quarter of an inch, I would say. They're very delicate, so they crunch between your teeth very easily. So even though you see, let's say, on a chicken, these big chunks of salt, they very easily crunch on your palate and have this wonderfully clean taste to them. Most of these salts are harvested from the sea. I should note here that sea salt is a highly unregulated term. Most sea salt actually comes from the San Francisco Bay and is refined like the other salts that we were talking about. So seeing the label sea salt does not mean that it's an unrefined salt. Unrefined salts will have these natural minerals. Usually they're from smaller producers. They're not what you would typically find in a big grocery store chain. So that you need to look for something in a smaller gourmet store, salt in Chef Salt, for instance, and there are other retailers selling the salt itself.
Yeah, there's so many of these hoaxes going around in the food world. Now, the more we talk about food, the more hoaxes develop, like all these people who think they're buying balsamic vinegar in the supermarket.
Right, right. Well, when things become trendy, people want to cash in and create a brand that is very marketable. And sometimes if the terminology isn't regulated, then consumers can be duped and buy something they think is, for instance, sea salt, and what you would think of as sea salt, which is an unrefined product harvested from the sea and evaporated from seawater. And that isn't always the case.
Well, now, tell me how you exactly went about this. Maybe we should start with how many seasoning combinations did you end up with?
Well, we first developed 12, and we have since released 6, and we've been developing new ones ever since, and we're releasing two new ones this year. So the 6 that we have out now are the Tuscan herb that we mentioned.
Which we love.
And then our signature blend is called 7 Salt. It's just salt and pepper, but it's 7 different salts and 2 different peppers, and it really shows how delicious unrefined salt can be.
Is that the one that's in the little jar that we have?
Yeah, we have a jar of that.
Yeah,
yes.
We have a jar.
Yeah, that has some very unique salts in it that we can discuss, but I'll just mention the others. The other flavors that we have out now are bacon barbecue. We make our own bacon. We used to use real bacon, and we ground it up, but we would have had to refrigerate the product, so we did switch to a dry bacon, which has the same components. It has protein, it has salt, it has sugar, it has smoke, and it has real smoke. It's not liquid smoke or some kind of fake smoke. The smoke comes from smoked paprika. So bacon barbecue is another flavor. Bamboo curry is another, and some of the unique ones we have are Tunisian fire, which is a North African blend that features coriander and caraway and saffron, a little chili pepper, some cardamom, a little bit of palm sugar, and a Moroccan sea salt that's harvested from the coast of Morocco. That one, you will not find a Tunisian fire blend anywhere with any kind of salt. So that is a really unique flavor combination, fabulous on lamb and any kind of poultry.
As an example, David, let me hold you up just a second here. In terms of using the product, in the case of the fire, which I was reading about just before we went on the air, in this case, for a number of your recipes, you're combining it with yogurt and making a sort of a coarse rub out of it.
Right. So we initially developed this line as grill rub. Andy Schloss is the other partner in Chef Salt, and he and I had a book coming out called Fire It Up.
You're on our website with that. Yeah, I like that book a lot.
Yes, well, our intention was to bundle a line of seasoning blends with the book. But once we started cooking with them, we realized that they were so much more versatile than just as grill rubs. But that is the go-to use for Chef Salt. Just sprinkle any one flavor of Chef Salt on almost anything that you're going to grill, and maybe you need a little oil if it's a piece of fish, for instance, but that alone will turn an ingredient into dinner. That is the whole idea. That's why our tagline is the chef's in the jar.
Okay.
Andy and I have years of experience developing recipes, particularly for home cooks, but we are chefs who develop recipes for home cooks, and we've been doing that for so long that we understand how simple people want it to be. So that's what we tried to do, is to capture all of the expertise of combining flavors and leaving some spices coarse and grinding others fine to get the maximum amount of flavor in a jar and make it easy for people to get dinner on the table.
Yeah, well, that's what people want. You're absolutely correct. I mean, I know I do.
But you also want to add some flavor, and
absolutely.
Until David and people like him came along, adding flavor meant you had to do some work for yourself.
Yeah, I used to do that.
Now we're having beer can chicken tonight.
Okay, terrific.
And I'm guessing
Tuscan herb would be good on that.
Yeah.
You keep on telling me I should have some more of it, but I don't have it.
We'll have to send you some more of that. Yeah, it seems like you ran out pretty quickly.
Well, they're very small packages.
But seven salt we have a jar.
Yeah, but that would be terrific as well.
Retail product wise, when you buy this product, it comes in a jar that holds about how many ounces?
It's about 3 ounces. It's a hex jar. It's about 3 ounces. It's about the size of your fist, each jar.
Great. So I'm in a position where I can do that, even though I lust after Tuscan. I can think of seven salt and five salts and two peppers, so I'll be in good shape.
Speaking of recipes, we have dozens of recipes on the website at chefsalt.com.
Oh, good.
And we send out recipes with every order. We write the recipes so they will each fit on the back of a business card. They are that
short. We have those. I don't know if Peter looked at it or not. We have a couple of those.
Well, I thought I knew what I was doing.
I see.
I only used one of them, and I was making lamb cutlets. I mean, how hard is that? It's really
there you go.
Really not too difficult. The chicken, the beer can chicken, just needs a... I usually put salt and fresh ground pepper on the outside, but I'm not going to use that crummy sea salt anymore. since you told me it isn't any good, I'm not going to use that tonight.
I would try the seven salt on the beer can chicken. I think that would be terrific.
Yep.
And you had mentioned the marinade that we use for Tunisian fire chicken kebab. And for this, we take a couple tablespoons of the Tunisian fire chef salt and mix it with some yogurt and just a little bit of water. And then you add the chicken and let it marinate in that yogurt marinade. It's similar to tandoori chicken.
Yes.
Okay.
There's acid in the yogurt, the acidophilus and the other beneficial bacteria that you hear about. Those are tenderizing the chicken because the acid breaks down the tough protein fibers. And it only breaks down the ones that are on the surface. But it does help to tenderize the chicken or make it more soft so it chews easier and it tastes more tender. So that is the purpose of the yogurt there. And it creates a sort of tandoori chicken, but this is with North African flavors, as I mentioned, the caraway and very aromatic coriander and cardamom, some saffron.
But that's what I used to make, but I had to do it all, like adding all those spices into my yogurt. Now it's so simple with your mixture.
Yes, exactly.
So all you need is that and the yogurt.
Right. No more ingredient lists that are 20 ingredients long. Yeah.
That's what I was getting at. I mean, that's what I used to have to do.
But now you could also use it as like a mopping sauce, couldn't you? So you could paint it on during the cooking process.
Absolutely, yes. You can mix some chef salt with a little bit of oil and glaze it onto meat as you're cooking. You can marinate ahead of time. You can make a little sweet and sour sauce, for instance, with some vinegar and sugar, and then add some chef salt into that, and that would create a nice lacquered glaze on chicken or almost anything that you're intending to grill.
What I'm fascinated by is when I read about how you worked at this, can you sort of describe what one of these sessions is like? Do you have an idea of what kind of product you're going to be making, or what? How do you start and how do you interact with each other?
It's funny, when we first developed this, Andy and I and Mark Bitterman were just kids playing on the playground. We just ideas kept bouncing off each other. I mean, he would say something about the taste of a particular salt, and then we would say, oh, that would be fantastic with saffron, and then we start talking about things we could cook using this blend, and we just came up with dozens of ideas within the span of 20 minutes. So we sat down and we thought, okay, what will people be most interested in? What do they really need help with? Since if they like exotic flavors and they want to go beyond curry, what can we give them? So we focused on the North African Tunisian spice combination, which typically has some coriander and caraway, and those are the defining aromas there. And cardamom, there are many different types of blends.
So you basically figured out the flavor profiles. Pretty traditional?
We did, and we used the salt as a jumping off point. So the salt here comes from the coast of Morocco, and
it's a
very clean, crystalline salt. I would say it's actually a base for letting the other aromas of the spices shine. So the salt itself, I would say, is not one of the most unique salts that we use, but in this blend, it's perfect because we don't want a salt that takes over the other aroma. Now, that said, in our New York steak blend, we use a salt called Kala Namak from India, which has a sulfurous component to it. If you smell our New York steak blend, it smells a little like egg. Eggs have a sulfur component. And the reason we use this is one of the things that makes meat taste meaty is sulfur. And this sulfur salt from India is considered healing salt there. And we use it, it's a black salt called Kala Namak or black salt in India. And we use that to enhance the meaty taste of a steak. So that one is used in our New York steak blend, so your grilled steak tastes meatier.
Well, that's interesting. Now, you've learned all kinds of interesting things about salt, and I'll tell you, the expert you're working with is amazing, Bitterman. He's just amazing how much he knows about salt.
He is.
Yeah, and like, how many, are you doing this continuously and full-time?
Yes, Andy and I are developing the blends. This is a very handmade artisanal product. Andy has a certified commercial kitchen. It's certified for food production. So we hand crack and toast the spices there. We blend all of the mixtures together there in 20 or 30 pound batches, and we fill the jars and we actually label them ourselves as well.
You're
we're trying to get away from that because it's very laborious.
I was going to say, if you grow as a company, how in the world are you going to keep doing that?
Yeah, we are going to hire a co-packer, they're called co-packers, to do some of the production, but not the actual making of the product, not the what's in the jar. We want to continue making that because what we are working with are, they are artisanal salt. They vary depending on the time of year, the length of the evaporation time. Most of them are made from seawater that is evaporated in pans on the coast, and they're evaporated several times. There are lots of different processes.
Yeah.
Sometimes the wind is used. They determine when the wind is ideal for just exposing the surface layer of salt on the sea, and then they scoop off the salt from the surface. A lot of pyramidal salts are harvested that way, and these salts actually grow in crystal shapes that are pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
They are upside-down pyramids on the surface of the sea, and they're absolutely beautiful, and they're delicate, and those pyramids just crunch in your teeth so wonderfully when you have them on food.
Now, this is what they call fleur de sel.
Yes, fleur de sel. Not all fleur de sel is pyramid, but yes, fleur de sel is
the same way. It's the same concept.
It's like Trapani salt, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Trapani salt is a fleur de sel, so are the salts from Maigmort in southern France. What you're doing is you're getting the just-made crystals, right?
Exactly.
Because you're scooping them off off a surface that's really still mostly seawater.
Yes.
And
there's only one more thing we really need to do.
I was going to ask this, how do you get these?
What I was going to do.
The web page.
Yes, Chef Salt is available nationwide at Crate and Barrel if you like to shop in a traditional brick-and-mortar store. This product is shelf-stable, so I see no problem ordering it online. It is available at chefsalt.com. Chef is one word and salt is another. It's just C-H-E-F-S-L-A-T.
S-A-L-T. You said S-L-A-T.
It's probably under Chef's Light as well.
Well, David, I mean, I can't imagine we're going to be seeing any books soon. I mean, you sound like you're pretty busy.
I am pretty busy, but actually I am working on a book. I've been doing co-author books lately, so it's easier to squeeze in a few other projects because when you co-author a book, you're only doing half of the work. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, well, we're going to get cracking with this chicken for tonight. So,
terrific.
Yeah, and it's good talking to you as always.
It was a pleasure speaking with you again as well.
And say hello to Andy for us.
I will do that.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back with a sweet segment.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again looking to... Isn't it amazing that we get that wonderful nectar from a tree?
It is really rather amazing. And I guess sap is sweet. But on some trees it's sweeter than others, and maple is a very traditional source. of sweetening that is often ignored unless you're pouring rubbish on pancakes. And Dory Ross has proven not only that it's a fascinating business, but you can also make a little money at it too. But the amazing thing is that people who tap maple syrup trees in Vermont are not called syrupers or maplers, they're called sugarers.
Sugar. Yeah, and they call the trees, not trees, they call them sugar bushes.
There you go. So anyway, here's a
And you can adopt one.
you can adopt a tree.
Well, let's listen to Dory.
But more importantly, you can learn about a sweet ingredient that's a little better for you than, what is that, high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
So here's Dory.
I've already been introduced to something I knew very little about, talking to Dory Ross of Tonewood. Dory, you have so much information on the maple industry, the maple syrup industry. You started to tell me about how you got attracted to this. You missed out a point. Was what did you used to do before you were involved with this?
I come from Canada, and I grew up on a farm. We did some sugaring as a kid in a very rudimentary way, but I was transferred with a company I was working with at the time in Toronto, the Gillette Company, to Boston, and that's how I came down to the U.S., and I continued to work for them in Boston for a total of 15 years.
And doing what?
And then moved up to in marketing.
Okay, because this is why I asked you this particularly, is that not only is this a brilliant idea, the whole concept of Tonewood, but your packaging and your brochures are drop-dead gorgeous. They're so appealing.
Thank you very much.
You caught me totally off guard to start with when I sort of wanted samples, and I couldn't believe what I was looking at. It was just
very kind. I really feel that maple is such a beautiful product. It's a gift from nature, and it deserves to be showcased in a very modern and beautiful way.
Well, that's exactly what you did. But now, why has all of a sudden maple become so popular?
Well, I think maple has always been popular, but I think it's one of those food items that has been under-realized. It's always been leftover pancakes, which is wonderful, but it's such a versatile product, and it has so many uses in terms of baking and as a natural sweetener. It's the perfect sweetener, and I think health concerns, people are trying to reduce the amount of sugar in their diet, and because maple is twice as sweet as refined sugar, it's low in the glycemic scale, it's high in mineral content, high in antioxidant compounds and content, it provides a wonderful natural sweetening alternative that you can feel good about, but still keep in mind that it is a sweetener.
Now, you didn't quite finish up the story of how you personally got involved. So let's pick up that story again, because that's an interesting story in and of itself.
That was off air you started.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
I live in a part of Vermont that is surrounded by sugar makers, and I have very close neighbors who are sixth and eighth generation sugar makers who I have been exposed to. I've been living in this area for 20 years, 10 of which full-time, and I couldn't help but appreciate what these artisans do. I call them artisans, but when I use that word with my neighboring sugar makers, they laugh. They take for granted what they do. They just do what they do, and they love it. They're passionate about it, but they don't feel like the modern word projects an artisan, but they are. And so I really appreciate what they do. I see how much work goes into producing maple syrup. And I thought that it was a culture and a historical significance that the rest of the world needs to appreciate and be exposed to.
Now, from a terminology standpoint, you're using two words simultaneously and interchangeably, but still unusually, and you call your friends sugarers. By definition, the product they make is maple sugar, but in fact, most people know it as maple syrup.
Yes. The terminology, they do produce maple syrup, but a person who makes maple syrup is called a sugar maker, and the stand of maples is called a sugar bush.
Yeah, that was the
other
question.
And ironically, where I live, our ski area, is called Sugar Bush. It's such a deeply rooted culture in this area.
Now, your website, you have explanations that I think a lot of people think they understand about maple syrup, but they don't. You have explanations of variations and process of sugar making, maple trees. What is your website?
The URL is www.tonewood.com. T-O-N-E-W-O-O-D, maple, M-A-P-L-E, .com.
And tone wood comes from what, the word?
Well, it's a combination of wood coming from the sugar bush and the trees themselves, and tone represents the four grades of maple syrup and the beautiful color tones that those grades of maple syrup have.
So the four tones? Right. Tell us what they are. Yes.
And they are, in Vermont, which is specific, the grading is different in different parts of the maple region, but in Vermont, grade A, Vermont Fancy, grade A, Vermont Medium Amber, and then grade A, Dark Amber. And then there's a grade B, which is more generally known as a cooking maple syrup, but there is a huge camp of people who prefer grade B for general uses. It's much more robust in maple intensity.
Now, how does your business work? Do you buy the sugar from the sugarers, and then you make it into various products, and then you sell?
I have a combination of ways that I work. I collaborate with my local sugar makers, who are these lovely, very experienced sugar makers. They actually produce the maple syrup, because that's what they do, and they do it with more expertise than I think anyone can. And they can the maple syrup normally in plastic jugs, but for me, they can it into my glass bottles, and I drop those empty glass bottles off to them, and I pick them up filled from their evaporators. They do it all for me. And then I do my own labeling and packaging here at home. And then I also work with some Vermont local candy makers. And the candy makers make my, what I call, solid forms of maple. And that's what I'm currently doing. I'm about to start a Kickstarter campaign, which is a crowdfunding campaign,
right,
to raise some money and funds to provide an in-house commercial kitchen so that I can do all of it in-house.
Oh, wow. Well, now, explain how this all interfaces with your Adopt-a-Tree program.
Sure. The tree adoption program is really the anchor for my entire Tonewood business concept, and that is really a maple tree adoption program where you can adopt a tree, and it's like a premium CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture. You adopt a tree, and over the course of a year, you receive three lovely gifts in the various forms of maple. And it does a number of things. It showcases the versatility of maple. It showcases the sugar makers behind each of these sugar bushes. And you can adopt from a specific sugar bush. And on my website, you can learn more about their family and their history and their culture. And it also supports the industry, as do all of my products. 1% of all of the sales of the Tonewood products are donated to the University of Vermont's Proctor Maple Research Center for climate change research efforts.
Now, let's talk next about some of these products. They're amazing. I love this little cube.
Yes, the cube receives a lot of buzz. It's a wonderful product. It's got some historical and cultural significance. Prior to refrigeration, this is how people used to store maple syrup.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yes, which is really fun because it has an indefinite shelf life, and you can grate it like Parmesan cheese, so it has a wonderful presence. I grate it over my cappuccino every morning when I have guests over. It's quite impressive.
Yes, I can hardly wait to do that.
Yes.
I'm drag it out for dinner parties. They can do this over ice cream, luncheons. They can do it into their yogurt. Oh, it's great. So I didn't know that was a revival of an ancient, a long-standing tradition.
And what's interesting, too, you can reconstitute the cube back into maple. It's 100% pure maple in a solid form, but you can put it into a pan, add a little bit of water, and it melts, and you can create maple syrup again.
What are some of the other products now? What about this seasoning? I thought that was interesting, too.
Yes, the seasoning is a really versatile product. It's a sweet and savory product. It's the only product that I sell that has anything but 100% pure maple syrup in it, or maple sugar. It has 80% maple sugar with some other spices, pepper, salt, and garlic. And it's a lovely seasoning that you can add to your salads, soups, a number of vegetables. If you're a Brussels sprout fan, as I am, it's lovely with Brussels sprouts.
Oh, well, that's a great idea.
We visited our son just a few days ago, and he has a recipe for creating a glaze for a pork loin.
Maple is perfect with pork. It's lovely with salmon. The seasoning is terrific over salmon, and just broil it. I use it and just pour it all over a chicken breast and throw it in the oven and bake it, and it's lovely.
Well, now, what we took to Adams that you sampled was a different thing altogether. It's the, what do you call that? It's not the blended seasoning. It's the other one.
The flakes, probably.
Yes, the flakes. Tell us about those.
The maple flakes are very lovely, light and crunchy consistency. It's different than a maple sugar, which is a finer consistency. This has a real crunch. So this is really terrific to put onto oatmeal. You can put it onto yogurt, ice cream. It's lovely to add to a salad and add that crunch. So it's, again, I've done away with refined sugar in our kitchen, and I only have my children and my husband and myself sweetening with maple product.
Well, you're in the right place for it, Vermont.
Definitely.
But every time we interview somebody from Vermont, I say, well, how come there's all this concentration of creativity and artisans in Vermont? I mean, it must be in the water.
It is, and Vermont's such a wonderful place because there is no large industry here. To stay employed and to make a living, you have to be creative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really supports so much creativity from the state.
Well, now, let's get down to how people can lay hands on the programs and get more information and also purchase product.
Sure. My product is available on my website, which I mentioned is www.tonewoodmaple.com. And I also have distribution at a number of lovely stores throughout Vermont, and my distribution is expanding. I'm hoping to expand into some accounts right across the U.S. So, but at this point, it's most available, obviously, on my website.
Well, that's easy enough to do nowadays, isn't it? So I wish you continued success with this program, and I really am looking forward to seeing how far you take it. You sound surely like you know what you're doing. You do.
Thank you very much. Well, it really, the concept is to support small-scale maple farming and the people behind this, and just to leave the message that these people work so hard, and to support them and support them justly, the next generations will take this incredible industry on, and it will go into the next generation. But these people really need to be supported and appreciated, and also the ravages of climate change research on the industry, there needs to be a growing awareness so that activities can be set up to help preserve the future of maple and maple production.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job. I'm sure you sold a lot of razor blades for Mr. Gillette, too.
This is much nicer than razor blades.
I'm sure it is. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Dory.
It was fun talking to you.
Thank you, Ann and Peter.
Bye.
And we'll be back with our final segment right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we go. We'll go right to the heart of the matter here with Paul Young, and he talks about...
Well, let's give people a clue, first of all, about language.
Language.
Because as George Bernard Shaw, I think, was reputed as saying, England and America are two countries divided by a common language. So there are many words that don't mean quite the same thing on both sides of the Atlantic. This program would be about candy. If it was in the United States, in the United Kingdom, when you talk about that, they're called sweets. And you buy from a sweet shop, not a candy store. But if you're really looking for the top of the game, you go to a specialist chocolatier shop here, both in the United States and in London. And Paul Young has become celebrated, and deservedly so, for the wonderful chocolate candies, or shall we say chocolate sweets or chocolate decorations or whatever you call them that he makes. He has several shops in London, but he also gave us a perspective on the whole business of making fine chocolate. So here's Paul, recorded in a previous program and brought to you today because all of you are in London and wanting to know exactly what to do with your spare time. So here's a suggestion.
It's always a wonderful surprise when I meet someone, even if I'm meeting them telephonically, that comes from the same part of the world as I do, and has gone on to make something of a success of his life in spite of his humble beginnings. And our current guest, Paul Young, who's calling us from England, I think, who's still working there and has built a wonderful career for himself making chocolate, has decided to share many, if not all, of his secrets with us. Paul, welcome to On the Menu, first of all.
Hello, how are you doing? Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, Paul, and you know, the book is called Adventures with Chocolate. And it certainly gets to be, by the time you get to the end of this book, it's just wonderful. But I like the subtitle even better, It's called 80 Sensational Recipes, and it's that too.
Oh, you should see the pictures. Sometimes I want to do video because it would be so wonderful to show these pictures.
Yeah, I did a tweet after I looked through your book saying that the photographs were so fabulous in this book that as I was reading it and turning the pages, I had an intense feeling that I was smelling chocolate.
If only the pages could move.
There you go. Now, how did you come to this place? It's not a conventional thing to be an artisan chocolatier.
It's not. It was all accidental. I trained as a chef and worked around Yorkshire and Durham as a normal chef. And just out of doing one job for a catering agency, I ended up working with some of Marc-Pierre White's chefs for a very big event and was lucky enough to be asked to stay with them on this event for quite a few months. It was a tour of the UK, and I got asked if I'd like to join permanently at Marc-Pierre White's Criterion Brasserie in London, in Piccadilly. That was in 96.
So he must have thought you were pretty good, huh?
They thought I was pretty good, thank goodness. So I packed up over a weekend, started working there, and stayed with Marc-Pierre White for 6 years, working my way up to head pâtissier, Quo Vadis in Soho. And as a pâtissier, I use chocolate every day. Not necessarily to make chocolates, but to make, you know, chocolate tarts, souffles, desserts. And 2 years after leaving, and I was doing other things, and between then, developing new products for retailers and teaching people how to bake and all kinds of things, really, chocolate started to take over. It just seemed to naturally be involved in my life, and it's a strange thing to say when you don't consciously do it, but every demonstration, every kitchen class, every cookery class I did, somehow every class ended up having chocolate involved.
Uh-huh.
And people in the industry started to ask me to develop chocolates for them to improve their current collections. Some really long longevity brands in the UK, like Charbonnello Walker. I was thrilled. I couldn't believe it. It was one of those things that really happened. And here we are, years later, with my own brand, three shops, and people really wanting to try new chocolates and to have them made in the artisan way.
Now, that's happening in the United States as well, to a significant extent, and you know some of the people involved in doing that. We're not sure the extent to which this had happened in the UK, so are you still the exception rather than the rule?
Even in London, I'm in London now. Like I said, I came down here in 96 and didn't go back to Yorkshire to live, but there's still not many of us who have specialised, especially when we're so close to Belgium, France, Holland, Switzerland, where every other street corner has a pâtisserie or a chocolate shop. Even in London, you can count on one hand who are the real artisan chocolatiers and who are the bigger mass production companies. I don't know why that is, because there's such a revolution of food here in the UK, especially in London.
Oh, yes, there certainly is.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, we come and look at it every year, and every year it gets more interesting and more interesting and more interesting, and the more new places opening. It is curious, but I guess in a way it's fortunate for you that the competition isn't there, so you can have three shops. If there's more competition, maybe you'd only have one.
Absolutely, and I think it's in a way, and this isn't meant to sound arrogant, it's meant to sound proud, because I've worked hard with my team to build up that reputation and to keep the chocolates and what we do the same from day one to now, which is 5.5 years later from opening our first shop, keeping that the same, looking after the customers, using the best ingredients, and not selling out, not mass producing, not replacing people by machines. And I think maybe that sometimes is intimidating for people coming into the industry, but I always try to encourage people to come into the industry and try to inspire them, which is why I wrote the book. That book isn't just for chefs, it's for people who want to have a go, who think, I want to try, I don't know where to start, I don't know even which chocolate to buy, but once they've read the book and looked through the book, they can have that little more confidence to get into the industry.
Now, you have some very good recommendations about how to go about obtaining your ingredients. The first is really so simple and obvious, you might say, no, why would you even say that? But you say, buy absolutely the best ingredients.
I do say that, and I say that because if you start with poor quality chocolate, or say, poor quality ingredients, so you bought an ingredient from a supermarket, for instance, which has been cultivated, so you're using herbs, and I use a lot of herbs, in spices, but say you've bought something that is really not great quality to start with, there's no way of making that taste good. If
right.
it doesn't taste good at the beginning, it won't taste good at the end.
And you, by the way, you make point teaching people how to taste chocolate.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, was a revelation. All kinds of little things like that chocolate's the only food that melts at body temperature.
Absolutely.
That's amazing.
Funny, because when we eat, and we all do it, we just eat and we enjoy what we eat. And if you're eating, for example, a pizza, in your head you know exactly what that pizza will taste like even before eating it, because you're so familiar with it, even if the topping is different. But with chocolate, there's so many unbelievably different varieties and tastes and textures in chocolate that you could taste a dark chocolate and really not like it at all and say, I don't like dark chocolate. But then try another one from a different country or a different percentage or a different producer has made it, and you can absolutely love it. So the key is to try lots of chocolate, and I think there's nothing bad in that, is there? I mean, there's nothing better than eating lots of chocolate.
Yeah, the only thing I can remember growing up that horrified me is that I didn't like milk chocolate, and everybody in the rest of England liked milk chocolate. All the chocolates around my family at Christmas time or birthdays were all milk chocolate, and I thought it tasted awful.
That's really odd, because obviously we're from the same area in the north of England, and we did have milk chocolate, but we always had dark. My mum always bought me dark chocolate, and I don't know why, but I seem to have more exposure to dark chocolate, no matter what the quality was, when I was younger, when other kids were having milk chocolate. So I think subliminally in my mind, I already had a little taste for that, of something more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all parents should give their children just a little bit of dark chocolate occasionally, because it has got lower sugar and fat levels, but also just for that little taste of something more intense and intoxicating, and a little bit more sophisticated as well. And you don't have to spend a lot of money doing that, just introducing something quite young.
You walk readers through basic recipes.
Yes.
Your first chapter here is the unadulterated chocolate. You do a little bit more experimentation with, I imagine half the population of Yorkshire would be appalled that you put chocolate in your trifle. Not to mention your
Christmas
pudding.
Trifle's out the window now, that's the problem.
But there's a reason why you're called the Heston Blumenthal of the chocolate world.
There is. I like to push boundaries, but I don't like to push boundaries for the sake of it. Don't like to mess around with ingredients too much that they don't represent what they started with, what I started with. So I want to inspire people and take things they're familiar with, like the humble trifle, which has such a long history here, and just adapt it.
And Christmas pudding? My goodness.
Oh, it's so good. So many people in the UK hate Christmas pudding. They really do. And I love it. So I wanted to give them something where they had everything that they love about chocolate, but transposed into something that they think they don't like or do love about Christmas. And it's one of those Christmas puddings that is so much more of a dessert and less intense and hefty after that big Christmas lunch.
Oh, yes.
And it's actually been taken really, really well. And so many people emailed me after Christmas last year and said, thank you, we made the Christmas pudding. And it was, I thought I didn't like Christmas pudding, but I do.
Is it too late to, we could send the recipe. Peter's sister Pat makes the Christmas pudding.
She may have her Christmas puddings already made, I think.
Probably.
Oh, you can still make it a short notice. Have two, have a chocolate one and a normal one.
Yeah, that's good.
She makes one, which is actually a vegetarian recipe, and she used to make them in September.
Oh, you should make them a year before.
Oh,
she says usually in September, so they must be made by now. What could possibly be wrong with chocolate pasta?
Almond tortellini with blood oranges and
there's
pines.
A story behind this recipe.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, tell us, because
it was the first thing I ever made on live TV here in London about nearly 10 years ago. It was a show called Great Food Live, and it was a one-hour live show where UK and international chefs came on. It was to inspire people, and I was taken on to cook inspiring dessert recipes. At that point, I was a pâtissier rather than a chocolatier. So I don't know why I chose one of the most complicated things to make on TV live possible. And it's that full recipe, and it hasn't changed. And it's the most lovely recipe.
What is alkalized cocoa powder?
It's cocoa powder, which you can get normal cocoa powder, which is just ground cocoa beans, the cocoa butter's been squeezed out and ground. And it's just normal cocoa powder. I think In the UK here, we just call it cocoa powder, and I think in the US quite often it's called the alkalized cocoa powder, so you can use any cocoa powder, to be quite honest.
That sounds wonderful.
Now, did you win?
Well, it wasn't a competition.
Oh, it wasn't a competition.
No, it was a live show. It was a daily live show, five days a week, all about food and chefs, and we cooked live on TV, and that was the first recipe I made. And that first recipe obviously was a clincher, because if it didn't work, would I be asked back? Probably not. And I was on the show for 5 years.
I should think you'd probably still be on it, except you probably, no, you didn't, couldn't possibly have run out of new ideas.
No, and unfortunately the show finished.
Okay.
So that was why. But that was the beginning. I wanted to just show people that, and everybody with the book, that you can take things, again, that you're familiar with, things that you know, things that people have in their cupboards and maybe haven't used in a certain way with chocolate. But
yeah, I mean, look at this one. Saffron and Greek thyme honey ganache. That's incredible.
It's gorgeous. Really fragrant. Something really good for summer. Not too heavy. Like I say, really fragrant and very sophisticated, but one of those things where when you have it, you just never go back to making another ganache for me. It's just one of those beautiful things that you can use. A ganache is the filling for the chocolate, the soft part in the middle. So you could use that over a cake. You could warm it and pour it over desserts. You could make truffles out of it. It's one of those things that I love sweetness from honey, and saffron is one of my favorite spices in the world.
Yeah, I do too. I like it too.
Yeah, we're running out.
Could you tell me about chocolate?
We're running out of saffron. We're gonna have to get some more.
Could you tell me what you do with a chocolate dressing on fish? That I'm not so sure about.
Well, there's some recipes in the book for sauces over fish. Red meat and vegetables and white meat.
And ice cream.
So I wanted something where, because I love fish and I love chocolate, and I thought, how am I going to get them together? They don't work if I'm trying to make a truffle or a bar of chocolate. Not very nice. But then what I started to look at was how sweet fish was when you taste it. It's a lovely, delicate, white-fleshed fish or a scallop or a prawn, and try to look at ingredients that work. So we know dill works. And I remember my French training at college back in 1989, one of the things we used to use a lot was Pernod, with fish. And
it was
a light aniseed flavour.
Right.
So then I started to put a little bit of white chocolate in, as a little bit of sweetness, to make the sauce really rich and smooth. And that recipe developed from, you know, all of that experience in 1989, and bringing it up to date. And it's one of my friends, a lot of my friends make that, because it's so unusual, yet so lovely. And of course you can make it the day before, but it works on all white fish.
Wow.
I don't know, I like to include chocolate in savoury dishes, but I don't want to make, you know, rich dark chocolate sauces just over the
ingredients. You mean like moles and things?
Yeah, yeah, I like that, but, and I like moles because it's full of spices, but over here when we see chocolate recipes with savoury ingredients, it tends to be venison with chocolate sauce.
Oh, right,
chicken.
Yeah.
Chicken with chocolate sauce.
Yeah, chocolate raspberry. That's a Gordon Ramsay recipe, the venison with the chocolate raspberry sauce.
Yeah, it's very popular in autumn here, but I wanted to use chocolate more as an ingredient rather than just an accompaniment, if that makes sense. I wanted to incorporate it into the ingredients I was using, into the main ingredients, like the fish, the meat, the vegetables.
Here's
so
one.
It becomes one dish.
Honey-cured bacon, Stilton, and chocolate sandwich.
This honestly has become an iconic recipe. It's one of the things that I've been included in so many magazines over here in the UK, because people just say, why, how, what on earth? But for Sunday brunch, it's honestly one of the most beautiful things to have. It's that balance of sweet, salty, creamy, chocolatey. It's beautiful. It works so well together. And it doesn't have to be Stilton. It could be any blue cheese.
Now, I've got two things I want to talk to you about. One, you got me worried here. And that's with your chocolate martini.
Oh, okay.
Because I worry about cocktails that you have to eat with a knife and fork or a spoon.
Right.
But you have enough reputation, and I've seen the rest of the book, so I have to believe probably that we'll have to try again.
Have you made it?
But I do. No, we haven't made it yet. I'm questioning it. I'm searching for why I would want to go do that.
To make a chocolate martini.
Yes.
Because I've had so many bad chocolate martinis that don't use chocolate. So I wanted to make a martini that did actually use chocolate and not a chocolate-flavoured syrup or a chocolate liqueur that had never been near a cocoa bean. I wanted to make something that was a really, like a dessert cocktail, drinkable, not sickly sweet, really has that intensity of chocolate and cocoa, but that still had that lovely kick. It's not a purist martini by any means, but it's a purist chocolate martini.
Right. So you have the you have to like the concept of a chocolate martini first, probably.
I think you do. You have to like those two things together, but it just works because martinis has got such a beautiful, crisp, clean taste, and dark chocolate can have that same crisp, clean, but intense and intoxicating taste. So I thought, pop the two together, and it worked really well. It is an intense drink. One or two is maximum.
Yeah, I bet it is. It probably slides down easy. But I have to wonder, and then I'm going to ask Anne to finish up the interview because I know she's itching to ask you another question.
Oh.
But I'm wondering if you got a lot of hate mail when people discovered that you mixed chocolate and Marmite.
No, thankfully. I tell you something, this happened because this was 5.5 years ago when I opened my first shop. A very dear friend of mine, Lydia Slater, who at the time was the editor of the Sunday Times Style magazine. She loved our chocolates, came into the shop, and I was using lots at the time when I was called the Heston Blumenthal of chocolate. She said, I bet you haven't tried Marmite. And I'd already been playing around with it, and she gave me that kind of challenge. And I said, right, leave it with me. As soon as I have a recipe that works, I'll call you. So I spent 2 months developing the recipe for Marmite truffle. And it has been on collection since that day in my first shop, then the second shop, and now the third. We can't take it off the collection. People travel from all over the world for it. Something that has become iconic with what we do. And it's about, that balance of sweet and savoury, but people do love it or hate it. And we can't take it off. It's just become one of, honestly, I think it's like a pop star who writes a hit single, and you have to sing it and sing it and sing it and sing it and keep singing it for 20, 30, 40 years, and you think, what have I created?
Exactly.
But you can't change it, and I can't. That's something I can never change. But do you know what it does? And it's probably the reason we're on the phone right now. And I did bring it to New York last year. I was at the chocolate show last year in New York, where we did a pre-launch for the book, where I let people know who I was, and we had a tasting. And same here in the UK. It was received so well. It got people talking about chocolate, which is what I want. I want people to come into my shops or see me at an event and say, why? Explain to us and talk to us about why. No matter how crazy people think I am for doing it, I think chocolate has to have some fun in it. And chocolate, and if there's no fun in chocolate, then we're doomed. We have to have some personality and some laughter and some kind of, why on earth would you do that? I love it or I hate it.
Well, you've got plenty of all those qualities, Paul, and I can't wait to get to London next time and hang out with you. Which shop do I go to?
Oh, Soho. Well, you've got to send me an email and come to Soho. I'll show you around. You can have a day together making chocolates in the kitchen with myself and my team.
Oh, wonderful.
You can both see how things are done, and then we'll go out for a chocolate martini at my favourite bar, which is only across the road. Some great guys make lovely chocolate martinis, and I'm sure I'll convert you into Marmite truffles, maybe.
Oh, I would start with one of those. After all, we'd probably be arriving close to breakfast time.
It is a good breakfast chocolate, especially if you have a port and Stilton with it. You've got a bit of cheese there as well.
Oh, Paul,
you're delightful.
I'm so looking forward to meeting you in person and continuing this conversation. It's been wonderful. Yorkshire has some great exports.
You know something? I cannot tell you how many people I work with in London and how many people have businesses in the food industry that are from Yorkshire. It's quite astonishing. I think there's so much creativity around seasonal ingredients. Places like Yorkshire where there's a richness of seasonal and local ingredients. But you need the volume of people and press and people like yourselves to kind of get in touch and let people, you know, explore that and make it grow.
Yes,
we're on the rise with good food, so let's keep it going.
Yes, so people have to leave to go to the big city in order to be able to make their mark.
Quite often, it's true, unfortunately, but quite a few still go back. As long as I can, post my chocolates and reach out to people in other ways, then and back home, then that's good for me.
Paul, what a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah,
thank
Paul,
you
thanks
much.
So much. Just
it's
love the book. Of all the books we get, this is one that I just heartily recommend that all of our listeners look for. Adventures with Chocolate by Paul A. Young. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you very much.
So as we conclude this week's program, you'll be noticing, of course, the British accents outnumber all others. So there, Mrs. Rabbit, you're laughing away, but let's end in the usual way. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.